Stay tuned for a Juno afternoon. Children's author Linda Wright will be here to highlight her Friday book signing at Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall. We'll get a preview of the music of Carol in Wonderland, the opening night concert dance of Juno Jazz and Classics. That's tonight. We'll talk with Jeremy Kane about ceramics classes at UAS. Janice Straley and John Straley will be here to talk about their new book about Ed Ricketts and their first Friday book signing at Hearthside Books downtown. And we'll talk with Elsie Coppins about her first Friday art opening at Kindred Post. She's 11. That's Juno afternoon. Stay tuned.
For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons in for Antonia Gonzalez. The organizer of the Gathering of Nations powwow in Albuquerque says he expects to have a new venue lined up within a month. That comes just days after the University of New Mexico announced it's breaking ties with the event that's been at the university's basketball arena for more than 30 years. Gathering of Nations founder Derek Matthews says he expects to keep what organizers say is the world's largest powwow in the city.
It's been a shock to a lot of people. And today we begin looking for our new home, wherever that may be. Obviously, we really and truly don't want to leave Albuquerque.
Matthew says it's become increasingly harder to deal with what he calls disrespect and disregard from university officials as he tried to keep the Gathering of Nations at the arena known as the Pit.
The many different hurdles and hoops, they'd raise the bar continuously to see how high we could jump to get past inspections and different things, and we continued to do that, and we kept that behind the scenes. It wasn't necessarily what we wanted to promote to Indian country, but we were doing that so that we could maintain the event.
University officials say they incurred a $3,000 loss for this year's Gathering of Nations that just wrapped up last Sunday. They say a recent similar event put them more than $200,000 in the black. Williams says the university's claims they lost money on the powwow are, in his words, bogus. A grand jury has indicted a former executive with the Southwestern Association of Indian Arts. That's the organization that oversees the annual Santa Fe Indian Market. The Santa Fe New Mexican reports prosecutors accused John Torres-Nez of keeping $37,000 raised by Native American artists meant for victims of the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. Torres-Nez insists he donated the money to the Red Cross. Torres-Nez stepped down from the Association of Indian Arts in 2014. South Dakota's Lower Brule tribe is making little progress getting back on track after a wave of corruption and mismanagement allegations. That's the assessment by Tribal Vice Chairman Kevin Wright, who took over after Chairman Mike Jandrew's death a year ago. As Jim Kent reports, the tribe is now the focus of a new round of negative press over misspent funds that came to light during a recent federal audit.
The Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General conducted an audit of tribal spending between 2009 and 2012. Officials found the tribe had over $900,000 in unallowable, unsupported, or unreasonable expenses during this four-year period. Lakota George Estes is spokesperson for grassroots elders of the Lower Brule Sioux tribe. He says many tribal members are still in the dark on the $900,000 in misspent federal funds.
We have yet to see any finances. There is 25 bank accounts our tribe has. We want to know what's in it. What's going on?
Estes says no progress toward government transparency has occurred since Mike Jandrew's death. He says Jandrew's supporters who are still on the tribal council refuse to work with Vice Chairman Kevin Wright. The vice chairman agrees and adds that even he can't get answers to how the tribe's money is being spent.
It seems like dancing around the whole subject and no definite answers as to what is our current situation as a tribe?
Multiple phone messages left for those tribal officials over the span of a week were not returned. Arvind Ganeshan is an attorney with Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C. He says there are at least three separate investigations into tribal spending on Lower Brule in addition to the Justice Department audit. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
A wildfire near Fort McMurray in Alberta, Canada, is forcing the evacuation of hundreds of First Nations residents. CBC News reports the fire destroyed the headquarters building that served some 300 Métis people. About 700 members of the Fort McMurray No. 468 First Nation fled the fire that's consumed more than 210,000 acres. They're among the some 80,000 people who have been displaced by the fire. For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, and our show is produced by Jeff Brown, who is also in the studio with us. Quick check of weather. It will be rainy and windy this evening and continued rain through Saturday, but it will taper off and change to mostly cloudy beginning on Sunday. So there's some hope for next week, with temperatures peaking out next week in the high 50s, but still kind of chilly spring weather. We have a wonderful lineup this afternoon on Juneau Afternoon. My first guest is children's author Linda Wright, who has written a book that she will be signing in person this evening, tonight, at the Hearthside Books in the Nugget Mall between 6 and 7, and the book is Fun on the Farm. Linda, you've had a very interesting life. You've had a number of significant experiences that have informed your thinking and your writing. Let's start with the title of the book, Fun on the Farm. You mention in the information about yourself that you were featured in a documentary about women farriers. Talk about, first of all, what a farrier is, and then your work with the farm that is the Greg Webster Horsemanship Program. And tell me how each of those two aspects of your life may have informed your book about the farm.
First, may I say thank you, and I do apologize to the listening audience for my lack of voice. It happened when I stepped off the plane. I'm in love with Juneau and everyone I met here. I will live here in a heartbeat, but my home is in Texas. And my book, Fun on the Farm, is a creative, imaginative adventure that came from life experiences, but wrapped up in the imaginations of my 5 grandchildren. They have talked to me, so we created the little book, our little characters, and all of the adventures and fun on the farm. The beginnings of the book develop much earlier than when my grandchildren arrived in this place. I began writing at the age of 9. I earned 5 cents. When I wrote an article in my small community newspaper entitled My Granny, she was a school teacher. She would grade my letters that I would write to her. She would return the letters to me with a letter grade. Every omission, change of spelling, punctuation, circled in red to be corrected and returned to her. That was my early writing experience, and I fell in love with being able to write anything and everything. And through the years, and as I approached the age of 70, I have found life is just full of so many adventures, and I stick to a belief that I passed to my grandchildren. In life, when you're on a mountain, you see the beauty from the mountain heights, and you look down to the beautiful valley that is below. But when you're in that valley, you appreciate the beauty and looking up into that beautiful mountaintop. So no matter where you are, if you're on the top of the mountain or you're in that valley, embrace the beauty and embrace the positive aspects that you have, because that's what life is about. And as I have traveled that journey, as I said, the beginnings of Fun on the Farm, which is my first children's book, began to develop. My grandchildren put it all together and said, Mimi, this is who we need to talk about. So we have some very imaginative characters you're not going to find on a traditional farm, but they're there and they do exist in the mind of a child.
Tell me about what being a farrier is about and how that might have impacted your thinking about a book that includes imaginative farm characters.
I can say that as a farrier, which is actually a blacksmith, horseshoer, not a furrier who goes out and collects animal hides.
But a farrier.
There are many aspects. First and foremost, you have to love what you're working on, horses. Who doesn't love a horse? From a child on upward, that was my salvation. I fell in love with horses. They fell in love with me. So I took that into a secondary career. My first career was raising my three wonderful sons. I had an opportunity to follow my career goal, become a farrier. And during that process, I learned how to work with the instincts of the equines, but deal with the problems often created by the individuals that own those equines. So there were many aspects to working with horses and mules and donkeys, and then some other names that I won't use over the air that we sometimes refer to donkeys as. And those were the individuals that were the owners.
So you had an emotional connection with these large animals that may have been a bridge into your thinking about as you worked with your grandchildren to develop this book, I would suppose.
And it is very intuitive with children, as you well know. They are emotional, spontaneous, and fun.
So in 2008, and we'll talk about this in a moment, you experienced a sudden and rare illness, Guillain-Barré, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But at the time, you were using your horsemanship experience and skills in running a program and a camp for Boy Scouts as well as the public. This camp was named after your son, Greg Webster. Can you talk a little bit about what that camp was and what its purpose was?
Camp Greg Webster came about when my son was diagnosed with a very rare form of cancer. It's a sarcoma. And from the time he found he had the cancer in him, we began making plans for what comes next in this life journey and after this life journey and our next journey. One of the programs that we put together, Camp Greg Webster, came about as a tribute to my son, Greg. He helped form the camp. He helped fund the camp and launch the camp with the guidelines and the fundamentals that we incorporated from my past experience as a certified horsemanship instructor and the work that I have done with horses throughout the years. Working with the Boy Scouts was a gradual transition into a really fun environment because we just incorporated everything from my son's upbringings, all three of my sons, their hunting, their camping, their fishing, the horsemanship, all of that into their Boy Scout program. We also included the horsemanship trail rides for the general public. All of this was put together in tribute to my son, my son's camp, which was named Camp Greg Webster. And we felt that we had satisfied his request for putting the camp together, and he was very happy to be present when we launched the camp and had our first campfire, camp out, s'mores event with the Cub Scouts and then later the Boy Scouts.
And he passed away then at 27?
At age 27, that's correct. In 2004, the camp began operation, and it went very well for 3 years. And then I became critically ill with a very deadly illness, and often fatal, referred to as Guillain-Barré syndrome. You may have information on that because it's in the news right now, linked to the Zika virus.
How did facing potentially lethal illness impact your writing and your desire to write?
When you're paralyzed with only the ability to blink one eye, you cannot talk, you cannot swallow, you cannot sit up, you can't do anything that you had learned all of your life to do, and you find yourself in a position, the only thing you have to use is your mind. And you can go into beautiful chambers in your mind, block out the nightmares, and go for the fun stuff, and find some really neat things and fun things to do. Limitations are limitations that you put upon yourself physically, mentally. You're free to go wherever. And that's where my creative aspect kicked in.
Well, you have been an inspiration to speak with today. We are talking with author Linda Wright. She is a Texan, and she has shared with us how some of her life-changing experiences, as well as working directly with her five grandchildren, help inform the book Fun on the Farm, which she will be signing this evening between 6 and 7 o'clock at the Hearthside Bookstore in the Nugget Mall. And it's a great night to be indoors. So enjoy your visit, Linda. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this opportunity in meeting you. This has just been a wonderful event. Thank you,
Linda.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 6th of May, 2016. It's the birthday of Randall Jarrell, born Nashville, 1914, a critic who was important in promoting the reputations of Robert Frost, Walt Whitman, and William Carlos Williams, and bringing attention to the poetry of Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop. During World War II, he worked as a control tower operator, and he wrote poems about the war. In his poem Losses, he wrote, "We read our mail and counted up our missions in bombers named for girls. We burned the cities we have learned about in school, till our lives wore out, our bodies lay among the people we had killed and never seen. When we lasted long enough, they gave us medals. When we died, they said our casualties were low." It's the birthday of Sigmund Freud, born in Freiburg, Moravia, now part of the Czech Republic, in 1856. Moved to Vienna as a child, lived there for 78 years until the Germans occupied it in 1938, then went off to London, died of throat cancer 1 year later. Freud started out as a doctor, became interested in psychology, especially in a mental illness called hysteria, which some doctors treated successfully using hypnosis. And that interested Freud, that a patient could be talked out of his or her symptoms, that the symptoms were a product of the mind and not the body. He treated a patient named Anna O, whose hysterical symptoms had improved when she told stories about her life. And he developed the idea that his patients were not conscious of all their desires and their fears, that many of their own thoughts were hidden from them in their unconscious mind. He believed that their unconscious mind would reveal itself through slips of the tongue, through jokes, and especially in dreams. And though Freud has fallen out of favor in the scientific community, his ideas of the unconscious and the idea of repressed feelings causing harm have entered our culture. And even though people haven't read his books, they're still familiar with the Oedipal complex, the ego, the phallic symbol, and the Freudian slip. Here's a poem for today by Ginger Murchison, the East Berliner, 1989. "They didn't come for the bananas, but everyone who came through that hole in the wall wanted one, the West ready with its Willkommen, mountains of yellow. After 28 years of concrete cold days and only those few flowers defiant in the cracks of denial, imagine the yellow fresh sight, that spike on the tongue, the fireworks and flares shot through the half language of heavy machines, shattering the cold Baltic chill, the half song, half wail of horns, sirens, and shouts, and behind it all, Beethoven's Ninth. Then that East Berliner, shuffling out, hatless and dazed, in a worm-eaten brown coat, to see it and not believe it, the bright yellow word he'll take home to his wife, tight in his fist." The East Berliner, 1989, by Ginger Murchison, from A Scrap of Linen, a Bone, published by Press 53, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games, Lumosity.com, and by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices, Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
If you'd like to keep up with the variety of activities, people, and events in the capital city, you'll want to tune into a Juneau Afternoon. Find out about concerts, meetings, events, classes, and speakers that add vitality to our community. Get to know your fellow residents. Plan your schedule. Learn what's going on and how you can be involved. Or be a part of the program by being a guest and passing the word about what you're up to. A Juneau Afternoon, weekdays live at 3 on KTUO News, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and available on demand via ktuo.org.
And it is a Juneau Afternoon. Welcome, glad you're with us. I'm Laurie Scandling with Jeff Brown here in the studio. It's a pleasure to have with us musician Carolyn Wonderland. She is the opening night act tonight of the three-weekend Juneau Jazz and Classics. Welcome to Juneau.
Well, howdy. Thanks for having us.
You should have brought us some sunshine from Austin. We would appreciate that.
I can dig that, man. If I could pack it up with me, I would.
So you're a young woman, but you have been in the rock/blues business for many, many years.
Yeah.
You left high school to become a musician. Talk a little bit about that decision and how you first came to be involved with music and that decision that I'm doing this.
I pretty much knew I was going to play music since I was 8. It was like the guitar was the only thing that held my interest. And so when I was invited to leave the school district after a protest, I decided that was probably fine for both of us then. And I started playing in bars that weekend.
You don't just play the guitar. You play some other instruments. Talk about that and how frequently you play those instruments. And if the guitar is your go-to, why is that?
I like the guitar, first off, because I could carry it around with me everywhere. When I was a kid, I learned some piano, but I couldn't very well put that on my back and run around. So the guitar ended up catching the most of it. And over the years, it's like stuff that I find in thrift stores or things that people find and, you know, I find an interest in. Like the lap steel is a hoot. I love to play it. It's easy to pack in with the guitar. And if you're stuck in the middle of a lake somewhere, you can paddle back with it. It's totally cool. And then the trumpet was, my aunt played trumpet in high school, so there was a trumpet laying around the house. I ended up playing on that, too. When we travel, I pretty much just bring those three, just the guitar, lap steel, and trumpet, because I can fit them all on my person.
Will we hear each of those instruments this evening?
To various degrees of success, yes.
So to watch you play and sing, you have a raucous voice. A voice that is somewhat reminiscent of the genre that includes Bonnie Raitt, Susan Tedeschi. I want to know, what is it like being, I'll just put it out there, a minority in an industry such as the music business in which the participants are very infrequently female? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, growing up, my mom played guitar too. So in my Girl Scout troop, for example, she would be leading us into here's all the verses to This Land Is Your Land, you know, and things of this nature. So I never considered that it was weird to be a girl playing until I was, you know, out in the bars. And on occasion you get that, you know, the treatment from someone at the club who's like, all right, whose girlfriend are you? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to drop the amplifier on your foot, my friend. But it's all right. I have to say it's sometimes challenging, and you kind of, I suppose, like comedians learn to deal with hecklers. It's a bit of that too.
In what way?
You have to learn how to be a touch on the tough side on occasion, and find things to say to get people to perhaps view you as a musician beforehand. It's hard to do. You pretty much just have to play and roll with it.
In other words, there may be a sense by others that you're not quite as authentic as male performers.
Yeah, you get that sometimes. But I think once you start to play, people tend to let that fall off. And by the third song, my makeup's all the way down to my chin anyway. I could look like any old man. It's just fine.
How did you develop your style? You could have gone a number of ways. You do play a variety of instruments. How did you get drawn towards more of the bluesy side of the music industry?
Well, growing up in Houston, I got, you know, when I was asked to leave school, the places that I could get into without a really bad ID and that I felt safer were the blues clubs, you know. I enjoyed all kinds of different music, but the places that I felt like I could go in and contribute something, you know, go sit in at a jam, it was definitely the blues clubs. And I liked it because everybody has a set, you know, of like, this is specifically what you do. You go here to this one, you go to the four, you go to the five, this, that, and the other. And it seems simple on the surface, but it is incredibly deep well. It's like if you're not really in it, it shows up real quick.
When you say really in it, talk to me a little bit about what speaks to you about the blues and being in it or not in it.
It's kind of like jumping off into the ether with your eyes closed. But if your soul is naked and it's scary, then you're probably on the right track.
How much of your music do you and have you written that you generate and originate?
Probably about a half to two-thirds of the set that you'll hear. You know, I've got about 7 or 8 records out, and most of it's stuff I write. But then I have, you find songs that your friends write or stuff that you think you might be able to walk around in those shoes. I like doing that, too.
Let's talk about inspiration, both for writing your lyrics and the music that go with it, as well as who has inspired you musically. So what inspires you as you're getting into that creative mode, and maybe who's mentored you or whom you look up to?
I can dig that. Mostly I write about things that irk me off. And, when you're happy, you're dancing about it. When you're upset, it's like pins are plentiful. And that's kind of where I'm in. I don't mind it. Sometimes it can be painful, though. You write about things that you don't understand and that hurt,
Mm-hmm.
There's a few songs like that. And then on occasion, you have to have a couple of things that have joy in them. And if you don't, then it's just a sad, sad show. And I think I picked that up mostly from folks like Levon Helm and Marsha mm-hmm. Ball, people like that that I was lucky enough to get to see and hang out with.
How about guitarists? Who do you look up to? Who inspires you?
Gosh, there's so many. Oh, let's see. At home in Austin, there's a cat by the name of Red Volkart, and he's like one of the best guitar players I've ever seen in my life. And you can go see him for $5 on a Sunday. It's kind of amazing. It kind of blows my mind. Golly, there's a ton in town. I'm lucky enough that we just went to Woodstock, and I got to go hang out with one of my heroes there, Cindy Cashdollar. And if you think I can kind of play the lap steel, she can really play the lap steel.
Talk about living on the road. How many days a year would you guess that you're on tour, and what kind of life is that?
Well, it's definitely over 200 in a year, and the summer you always hit a little bit harder, so 90 days, I'll be home for 7 of them, and hopefully my cat will remember who I am, and my husband is very kind, so this is a beautiful thing. He puts up with my calls.
I think you got married not that long ago,
yeah.
Right? Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you, man.
Yeah, it must be challenging to be an itinerant person and to try and hold down a steady place and a steady relationship.
Yeah, fortunately, he's hip to it. He was a touring comedian for many years, so he understands the road. In a hotel, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Carolyn Wunderland, she opens tonight.
Yay.
At the A&B Hall. It's very exciting. The concert is at 7:30. This is the first weekend of the Juno Jazz and Classics, and she and her trio will be the opening act, and bring your dancing shoes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us.
But it's true what I say in the middle of this. Papa Molly did teach me how to sing this particular one.
Well, it ain't nobody's fault but mine. Said it ain't nobody's fault but mine. I said,
nobody's fault but mine. See it back.
Welcome back to a Juno afternoon here in a very warm studio at KTOO. It's a pleasure to have Janice Straley and John Straley, authors from Sitka, here with us today to talk about their new book about Ed Ricketts. They will be having a First Friday book signing at Hearthside Books downtown today, and this is a preview of their book about Ed Ricketts. And my first question was, who's Ed Ricketts? But before we get to the subject of your book, Jan and John, each of you talk a little bit about your own work as authors.
Well, I'm a marine biologist and a faculty at the University of Alaska Southeast based in Sitka. I've previously I've only really published scientific articles. So this is my first foray into these.
And your focus is on whales, is that correct? Is
yes.
that your area
yes.
of study?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and this is your first foray into just general nonfiction writing about a person?
Correct.
Biography?
And however, I did study marine biology in college, so
okay,
it's not too far of a stretch.
And John, talk about your work. You're a well-known author.
I'm a novelist. I've written, eight novels, two historical novels set in Alaska, and six private eye mystery novels. And I was a private investigator for years. And Jan and I run a business called J. Straley Investigations, which is has the crime division and the science division. And I'm the head of the crime division, and Jan is the head of the science division.
You go after humans, and she goes after whales.
We both do. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been fun. And mm-hmm. and Ed Ricketts is an inspiring guy to both of us in our whole life in Alaska. When we moved here in 1977, we became deeply interested in the story of how Ricketts came to our town, Sitka, Alaska. And Jan, you should tell them about it.
Well, Ed Ricketts was a marine biologist based in Pacific Grove, California, and he ran a biological specimen collecting business. And he was also working on a book on intertidal biology with a man who lived in Sitka named Jack Calvin. And so Ricketts and Calvin published this very pivotal book on marine biology called Between Pacific Tides. And I used this book in high school. And the range extensions all ended in Sitka. And when I got this job offer in Sitka, I said, whoa, I've got to go there, because it was really an influential book in my life and career choice. So I ended up in Sitka, and John thankfully came with me, and we've made a life there ever since. And so, and Nancy Ricketts lives in Sitka, and it's really a great story. They in 1932 they Joseph Campbell, the power of myth.
He wrote
Ed Ricketts and Jack and his wife Sasha, all rode up in a small boat, 33-foot boat, from Seattle area to Sitka, collecting specimens and in basically investigating the intertidal. And they wrote a very nice, he never quite finished it, or he thought he never finished it, but he wrote a really nice paper on wave shock, basically how waves that hit the beach influence how animals live on the beach. It's essentially how place shapes your life. And I've always wanted to publish that book, or that paper, and this is basically the core or the background of this book.
And
so,
Ricketts became famous as a character in John Steinbeck's books. John Steinbeck is a Nobel laureate, wrote Grapes of Wrath, and he wrote Cannery Row, and there's a character named Doc in that. never identifies him completely, but Doc is Ed Ricketts. And about Ed Ricketts is the essay that John Steinbeck wrote in the beginning of the Log of the Sea of Cortez, which a lot of Alaskan adventurers have read that book in high school. And Ricketts and Steinbeck and Calvin and Joseph Campbell and also the Kashaviroff daughters from Juneau all lived in Monterey in the 20s and the 30s. And Xenia Kashaviroff married, it's flying right out
John
of my
Cage.
John Cage, the musician and composer. And it was a rich cultural milieu down there.
And art and science. And
arts
music.
And science. And Ricketts loved all the arts and all the sciences, and he loved to have spectacular parties. And it's what Steinbeck liked to write about and in these parties. And so our book, Jan's book, is a collection, tries to help the reader who might just come for the science of wave impact, but help understand this amazing man who is credited with also helping develop the whole philosophy behind ecological thinking, along with Aldo Leopold, who they never met, but they've both developed this the what has become sort of our cultural heritage now of ecology. But Ed Ricketts. And they did a lot of that thinking on board the Grampus in 1932, coming up to Sitka.
And Nancy lives in Sitka, and I received permission from both her and her brother Ed Jr. to publish this essay. And it wasn't sufficient to publish as a peer-reviewed paper in a science journal, and it wasn't quite enough to stand alone. So I basically brought in six essayists to help framework the wave shock essay. So it would give the reader a bigger picture of what that wave shock essay is all about and the characters that are involved in the story.
Jan, what were the challenges of going from being a science writer primarily about marine biology / the whales that you study to preparing a series of essays that needed to bring out more than the scientific work of a man? We talk about the shock wave effect, but it sounds like he was in his own way a shock wave. How did you bridge that?
He was. Well, I think our publisher, Katrina Pearson, really helped with Shorefast Editions as a local publisher, and Ben and Nancy had a lot of nice photographs, some that have never been published before. And so the photographs, the publisher, the graphic artist, and Sarah Asper Smith, and also the artist on the cover and the intertitle pen and ink drawings that are inside were done by Norm Campbell in Sitka. So it's a local effort. So I think the combination of everybody was so enthusiastic and really loved this idea and this concept, so they all helped me bring it to a full reality. So I don't think it was just me alone. I think it was this combination of people that were really excited about it. And we brought everybody to Sitka last July, and everybody read their essays and tweaked their essays, and were all willing to give and take to make it a one cohesive book. So that really helped. It was like being on the boat with Ed. We all came to our house in Sitka, and we all just sat over a whole day and read the essays and talked about it. So it was really fun.
Talk about a rich stew of creativity, such as the life that Ed Ricketts himself led.
It was really fun because the essayists most of them had never met each other, and that gave them all the challenge to write an essay based on the wave shock essay. And so they all did that, and then we came together. It was wonderful.
And we all came together in the same place that Ricketts had been when he wrote the wave shock essay. I mean, we were walking those same beaches, and part of his philosophy was that place shapes everything.
Indeed.
The location shapes everything, and so Jan followed through with that in how she produced the book. It brought all the writers together because the place will inform the writing.
We should emphasize there are 9 contributors credited in the book. It is published in Southeast Alaska by Shorefast Editions. It's a beautiful text. I'm looking at it right now. And the title, which you've explained nicely in terms of the connection to Monterey and a Steinbeck, Ed Ricketts, from Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska. What makes this book different from any other biography of an Alaska-based character? And there are lots of interesting Alaska-based characters.
Well, Ricketts wasn't really Alaska-based. He only took this one trip to, but he and Calvin were pivotal. But the thing that makes this so different, this book, and so, I think, fun and special is that, like Ricketts himself, this book is a combination of fine art, oral history, humanities, and science. And the ideas that Ricketts was developing in science had wide impact with Joseph Campbell, who was finding ways to cross boundaries in his own profession, in his own chosen field. And this book honors that. So it's not just for scientists, but it's also not just for people interested in oral histories. It really is a sort of a history of an idea in which Ed Ricketts himself was the tip of the spear in our culture.
Arts and science integrated in it. You'll be signing this book, Ed Ricketts, from Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska, today at the downtown Hearthside bookstore as part of our First Friday. What time will you two be there?
We should be there at 5 o'clock if we don't fall asleep.
5 to 7.
You have time for a short nap between now and then. Thank you so much to Jan and John Straley. They are scientists from Sitka. They have contributed with other contributors to the book, Ed Ricketts, from Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska. It's a beautifully published book put out by Shorefast Editions, and it is filled with drawings as well as some fascinating pictures of Ed Ricketts and those with whom he worked and interacted in Alaska and down in Monterey. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so
much.
Thank
you, Lori. It's been great.
This is Bird Note. When Swainson's thrushes first returned to nest in the woods of the West or the northern states in Canada, they announced their presence with subtle calls. Limpid, whit, or wink sounds. About a week later, generally at dusk, they break into full song. Many rate the Swainson's thrush among the finest singers. And two of its closest contenders for musical elegance are also close cousins, the veery and the hermit thrush. All three are small brown birds, but their songs, each reedy or flute-like, clearly distinguish them. While a Swainson's thrush song spirals upward, a veery's phrases tend downward in pitch. The hermit thrush sings ethereal, paired phrases, long flute-like notes backed by complex, reedy phrases. Each is worthy of a long, silent pause in the woods. The Swainson's thrush. The veery. The hermit thrush. If you know someone who might enjoy today's program, you can forward it to him or her from our website at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Join friends of the Admiralty on a day-long cruise to Hawk Inlet on Saturday, May 14th for an extraordinary opportunity to learn and converse with the experts in a day of wildlife viewing, Tlingit and Cannery history, marine science, and Greens Creek mine operation, with the music and poetry of the talented Linda Buckley to serenade the return. Cruise tickets are limited and available at Hearthside and Rainy Retreat bookstores and at the Jack. Cruise loads at 8 a.m. at Statter Harbor in Auk Bay and returns at 4 p.m. This message is brought to you by the Friends of Admiralty.
And back to a Juno afternoon. With me in the studio is Jeremy Kane. He has instructed ceramics at the University of Alaska Southeast here in Juneau for 13 years. And he has an intensive program planned for the first summer session. And he's here to talk about that ceramics class. It begins May 16th, so in just a few days, and lasts until June 12th. And I was shocked to hear it's 4 days a week, 4 hours each of those days. Why is it so intense? Jeremy, talk a little bit about what will happen in the class. 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. That sounds like a true immersion.
Yeah, it's a great way to spend the day when you're making things, and it kind of helps you when you're clean up and your process. It takes so long to clean things up and to get set up that, you know, when you want to try to take a break for an hour and look at images and see pictures and talk to the students about things, the class goes really fast. So, you know, and also when we do it all into 1 month, it's better for people's travel schedules and things like that, you know, so they're more apt to commit to that, you know, 1 month rather than 3 months during a regular semester. But it's not much different than what we do during the year, except classes are offered once a week for 4.5 hours. So that's, you know, the summer classes. Most universities throughout the lower 48 have 1 month summer intensive courses. And, you know, it's designed mainly for intermediate and advanced students to better their skills and to really be in there every day and to kind of get the feel of what a working potter would really be doing rather than just, you know, coming in from time to time.
When I think of working pottery, I think of it kind of in an historical sense, and
sure,
that is that pottery really was one of the first expressions of civilization, if you will, in terms of the ability to store food such as dried grains. How have ceramics and pottery changed over, let's say, 4,000 or 5,000 years? You don't need to give me a treatise,
sure,
but has it changed really that much?
You know, well, one thing you could throw out, which is the natural, easy answer, is people are now printing 3D with clay. So that's a huge, you know, you've heard the term, you know, you can't reinvent the wheel. And I think that is very similar to, you know, ceramics.
Or maybe it has been reinvented through the 3D process.
That definitely is reinventing the wheel a little bit. But that's about the main, you know, improvements. I think that, you know, there's quite a bit of industrial ceramics being done, you know, with NASA and things like that, and NASCAR and things, just because it's a great heating element, you know. But as far as pottery, you know, like, it still keeps evolving. People keep doing new things, and, you know, you know, every year I go to a conference for the national. It's called NCECA, and it's the National Clay Conference. And you always see new things, and people are pushing it to different levels. And it's not just pottery; it's large-scale sculpture and things like that too. You know, so you know it's being pushed quite a bit.
What's pushing it is there new technology associated with? I mean, using clay, it's a heavy product, and what kind of technology allows it to be used in a greater variety of ways now?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, you have to remember that, like, you know, for one, like coal or manufacturing of toilets and sinks and, you know, all this kind of industrial ceramics, it's cutting edge, you know, like with injection molds and things like that. And every day people use ceramics more than they probably do anything else.
They probably don't realize that.
Plates and facilities and restrooms and floors and tiles and, you know, so The more kilns have been improved, the more people can mass produce things successfully.
What's the largest thing you could make in a ceramics class? In other words, what's the kiln capacity out at the university?
If you really had somebody wanted to, you know, large scale sculpture or a piece like that, you know, you're looking at about 3 feet by 3 feet, something like that, probably. You know, so you could make something pretty large. It's just moving it and having the place to store it and things like that. So, you know, at UAS, it's a small studio, you know, so you kind of have to work within the parameters of the space, which is another great reason for the summer class, because when you have 10 or 12 students, you know, you have a lot more space and a little less cleanup time, because you can keep that wheel for a day or two, you know, and, you know, just clean up the floor around, but you can leave your wheel a little bit of a mess, because, you know, you're going to be back to it every afternoon and you're not having to clean it up for somebody else because everybody's going to be in the class together, you know.
How did you get into ceramics? I can picture you, like, at age 16 in high school telling your parents, yeah, I think I'll teach ceramics, and they're clutching their chest.
Yeah, it wasn't quite like that, but it was, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I think I learned how to center a ball of clay when I was about 9 years old, and I worked with clay for about 3 years straight, and you know, really rough pottery. But, you know, I still have seen some of that stuff that I've made, and you know, it just got me excited about making things for that 3 year period, you know, and my parents would drop me off at the pottery studio and I'd hang out there for 5 hours, and, you know, and it always felt good. You know, I played sports and things like that too, but it was more fun than going to baseball practice. You know what I mean? I like to play games, but practice, you know, it's like I'd rather be in the studio making things. So when I went to college, which was in University of Alaska Fairbanks, with my best friend, you know, we grew up together. He and I both were in that class together when we were kids, and we were like, we should take ceramics because we used to love it so much, you know. And so we got back into it in Alaska. So.
And are doing it professionally.
Yeah, so that's been 22 years ago.
Now, you've mentioned the class is more for intermediate and advanced students, and I know you just have a few slots left, but what skills does somebody need to have to be successful at ceramics?
Well, I mean, for one, it's a kind of an organizational thing, you know, so you have to be well organized and you have to have patience and you have to be willing to fail, you know, and it takes a while and you have to be able to see that the one thing that you got out of the process that keeps you going rather than like, you know, counting numbers or wanting everything to turn out the way you know, expectations, you know, sometimes get in the way when you're in the intermediate stages of pottery, you know, and for an advanced is kind of a loose term for anybody, you know. I consider myself an intermediate student still, even though I've been teaching for 13 years, but I learned so much just from, you know, when I have 45 students every semester, I learn a lot about clay still. You know, there's not that often do new things happen, but you write a few things down every once in a while that had never happened before.
If someone's interested in this class, where can they find more information and enroll if they so decide?
Well, this is, you know, we've had a flyer up, and this is the first advertisement I've done on the radio, and they can enroll at the university.
Through UAS.edu?
Yep, or they can go out and, you know, they can come out and see the facility a little bit and see what's going on first and sign up out there, or they could do it online.
Okay, if someone has some questions, can they give you a call?
Sure.
What's your number?
My number is 907-957-1181.
1181. We're with Jeremy Kane. He teaches ceramics at the university, and there is an intensive summer class that will begin on May 16th. Maybe summer will begin by then too, Jeremy.
I think we're getting some nice weather here soon.
I hope so. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay, thank you.
Celebrate Juneau's maritime history, culture, and commerce at the Juneau Maritime Festival on Saturday, May 7th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the downtown Marine Park and Plaza. Enjoy delicious seafood, live entertainment, and engage in many fun-filled activities for both children and adults, including I Spy, Taku Tilt Races, 16B Dock Tours, and more. For the first time ever, the blessing of the fleet will be on the same day at 10 a.m. at the Fisherman's Memorial. This message brought to you by the Juneau Economic Development Council.
Hi, I'm Sarah Istoe.
And I'm Richard Stokes. We're sponsoring the Juneau Poetry Broadside Show opening at the K2 Studio on the first Friday in May.
A poetry broadside is a collaboration between a poet and an artist. Broadsides are printed in small numbers and intended not only for display, but for public distribution.
The ones in this show are by Juneau poets working with Juneau artists, calligraphers, and photographers.
There will be a reception from 4:30 to 6:30. The broadsides will be on display at K2 throughout the month of May.
Juneau Jazz and Classics kicks off its 30th season Friday, May 6th, with an opening night dance party featuring the reigning queen of Austin blues, Carolyn Wonderland. Think of the soulful vocals of Janis Joplin and the guitar-slinging skills of Stevie Ray Vaughan. Catch her Friday night at A&B's Elizabeth Karachevich Hall or either of the blues cruises Saturday from off day at 5 and 9 p.m. Both feature Anojo Sar and more. Carolyn Wonderland, Friday, May 6th, and blues cruises Saturday, May 7th. More information at jazzandclassics.org.
And our final segment this afternoon on Juneau Afternoon is a special one. We have a very special guest here who will be introduced by Christine Name. And she owns Kindred Post, which is right downtown at the corner of Franklin and Front. And it being First Friday, there's a special event there. Welcome, Christine. Why don't you talk a little bit about what's going on?
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Thanks for having us here today. We're pretty excited because this First Friday, we're changing things up a little bit. We've been having a lot of interactive photo booths over the last couple years, and I really want to start doing different creative interactive activities with the community on First Friday. And so I'm really excited to welcome Elsie Copens to Kindred Post this evening. She has started up a letter writing business, which I want to let her talk a little bit more about. But she's going to be there this evening from 4:30 to 7, kind of doing a little bit of a demonstration, doing some sample postcard letters. And her, along with her mother, Julie Copens, is going to be there playing some music on her baritone ukulele, are going to be setting a little bit of a letter writing tone for us.
So, Elsie, you're a woman after my own heart. I love receiving and writing letters, and I have throughout most of my life. You are 11, is that right, Elsie?
Yes, it is.
All right, when's your birthday?
January 5th.
So you just turned, you are 11 for the last few months.
Yes.
And are you in sixth grade this year?
I'm going to be in sixth grade.
Okay, so you're finishing fifth grade right now. Let's talk a little bit about your letter writing business. What does that involve, and how did you develop that idea?
Well, really, it was actually kind of from my mom. Like, I told her that I really, like, love to write, and I love writing stories, and I also really like to write letters. And she told me that it would be a good idea if maybe I could set up a letter writing business, and that's when Mountain Goat Notes started. That's the name of the business. And, yeah, and I'm really excited for tomorrow. And, yeah, for First Friday.
Tonight.
Oh, tonight.
Yeah, you've got about an hour. You've got about a half hour to get ready, girl. So
yeah.
If I were to use Mountain Goat Notes, how would your business help me? Describe that.
Well, nowadays, it's like electronics is the main source in a lot of households, and people forget about letter writing a lot of times, and pen pals become email pals, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it would be a good idea to kind of restart that and become more popular again.
So you're talking about handwritten real letters and postcards.
Mm-hmm.
What is the prime piece of advice that you give to people, young and old, who would like to write a letter or a postcard? How will you help them? What will you tell them?
I would tell them that it would be a good idea to, like, talk about their personal lives and say, how are you doing, and pretty much ask questions. And sometimes people are kind of afraid to write, like, let's say, love letters and stuff, and sometimes they need another person to write that.
Are you willing to write a love letter for somebody?
Well,
if they give you the ideas, you can pen it?
Yes. Yes, I am.
So kind of an all-round correspondence service, really.
Yeah.
What's the longest letter you'd be willing to write for somebody?
Well, really, there isn't a limit, but I guess maybe like 4 paragraphs or 5. I don't know.
With an emphasis on questions about the person who's being written to, as well as information about the individual.
Yeah.
What's the best way to sign a letter?
To sign a letter?
Like, kind regards, or X0X0, or hugs, or what would you recommend?
It depends on who you're writing to. Like, if it's more of a business type letter, then it would be more like best regards or sincerely. Or if it's to someone you care about, it could be love or your friend or best wishes. Or sometimes you could be more creative, like I love you forever, or yeah.
So creativity abounds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Elsie, you obviously have a passion for what you're doing, and Elsie Copens will be at Kindred Post, which is at the corner of Franklin and Front, beginning at 4:30 today with letter writing advice. Join us Monday on Juno Afternoon, and we're glad that you are with us today as well. Have a great weekend.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and